Bitter. So, as always, I will start off by just a little bit of introduction to meditation. Then we'll do a guided meditation afterwards. And then we will talk a little bit again after that again. That's the plan. So, I thought today I might say a little bit about Vipassana meditation. Please don't tell Ajahn Brahm I'm talking about Vipassana meditation. No, I'm just joking. Please tell Ajahn Brahm. Tell him whatever you like.
I'm gonna Let's just say
And very often, it's very interesting. Sometimes people call the monastery and they ask questions like, do you teach Vipassana meditation at the monastery here? And I'm not sure what to say when they say that. Anyway, Vipassana meditation is kind of one of those words you hear everywhere. People say, people think this is equivalent to Buddhist meditation, Vipassana meditation, but actually Vipassana is only one aspect really of meditation practice. So I want to just maybe look a little bit about how we can use Vipassana in our ordinary meditation practice, even here tonight, what we actually need to do that. And as always, meditation practice always starts with calming down, finding the ease in the body, finding ease in the mind, becoming relatively peaceful. And then, somewhere along this track, as you are moving towards peace, as you're moving towards calm, you find that there will be obstacles where suddenly you can't go any further, right? You're blocked. Something happens inside of you. You think about the past or the future. You get upset about something, right? Or you get some kind of desire comes up in your mind. There's always these obstacles inside of us. And one of the biggest, one of the most dangerous, and the most greatest hindrance in meditation practice is the obstacle of ill will. So you get upset about something, right? You think about something that happened during the day, and then some kind of negativity or ill will arises in the mind. And this is one of the biggest problems. So the way then, how to deal with this, this is often what we call vipassana. Vipassana really means like clear seeing. It's a word in the ancient Pali language. It's basically having clarity about what is happening in a meditation practice. So when you, as you become more peaceful, you actually have more ability to understand what is happening in your mind. You have more clarity about what's going on. And because you have more clarity, it's easier to see where things like ill will, what it is, first of all, right? These things are very broad, they have many different meanings, they come in very strong versions, and medium versions, very weak versions. So just having the ability to know this is ill will, right? This is already one of the first steps. And then it is to understand ill will in a broader category. In other words, what causes that ill will? What causes that negativity? What gives rise to these things? And this is a very important part of this thing we call Vipassana practice, to understand the relationship between cause and effect. Why do you get ill will? And the reason is always, it's very simple actually, the reason you get ill will is always the same thing. Is you're looking at something which is not pleasant, which is not nice, and you're finding fault-finding with it, right? This is bad, this is negative, this is difficult, and then ill will arises as a consequence. So one of the things that we're trying to discover here is why ill will arises. And you will see that it tends to have certain objects, right? There are certain people in life that we find difficult. There are certain situations we find difficult. And these are the things that normally gives rise to these kind of problems. So this is, in essence, one of the important things to uncover in our meditation practice. Really, it's about understanding yourself, right? Getting to know yourself. We have all these aspects. Some of the aspects we don't really want to know about, right? It's not pleasant to see some of these aspects. But the only way you're going to make progress in meditation practice is to be, as you might say, brutally honest with yourself, right? You'd have to be tough with yourself sometimes. And let's see, well, this is the reality, and it's okay. Remember that the point here is not to judge yourself and say, I am bad, or I am evil, or, you know, you have these things. You have to be, this is just the way you are. And that's okay to be the way you are. It's not about judging yourself, it's about knowing yourself and understanding yourself. And as you do this, as you start to uncover the causes for the arising of ill will and negativity and anger inside of yourself, then you are actually able to do something about it. If you don't understand what it is, how it arises, there's almost very little you can do about it. So understand what it is, understand its causes, understand that there are specific habits in the mind that tend to give rise to these negative feelings. And once you get that understanding, then you can start to apply the antidotes, right? So these are the antidotes. Antidotes. So, and this is some of the, again, beautiful teaching defined in the Pali Canon by the Buddha and by some of his senior monks. And there's one particular place where Venerable Sariputta, he was a very famous monk at the time of the Buddha. He was the Buddha's right-hand disciple, essentially. And he says talks very beautifully about how we can overcome anger, negativity in all situations. And one of the important things is to recognize that very often ill will and anger relates to other people. Other people are always difficult, basically. That's kind of how life works. If whether it's our perception or they really are difficult is really irrelevant. We feel they are difficult, and that's what the problem is. So the first thing to do, the first thing Venerable Sariputta says we should do, is to understand that very often people are very complex, and they have very different aspects to them. Yes, they may have bad aspects, you know, bad, but then they also have good aspects, right? The good sides to them. And very often what we need to do is to try to understand, instead of focusing on the negative things. It's very easy to focus on the negative, right? Remember the negative and see that. Instead of focusing on the negative, is to learn to change our attention over to the positive qualities in that person instead. And very often they are positive qualities. And the amazing thing, when you come to a group like the Armadale group, for those of you who are new, it may not be so obvious, but that probably is obvious to you as well. It's amazing to come to a group like this, right? Here are people who are dedicated to kindness, dedicated to keeping morality, dedicated to helping others, to be generous. What a wonderful thing it is to be part of a group like this, right? And when you remember that, when you keep that in mind, then any fault, there's always going to be faults as well, that's just life, but any fault becomes tiny in comparison to the good qualities. So keep those good qualities in mind. And when you keep those in mind, then if you see some kind of ill will is about to arise, you very quickly shift your attention back to the good qualities instead. And by doing that, what you often find is that the negativity just disappears just like that. It can happen anyway. If you are skilled at it and you have built up a very strong perception of the good qualities. So this is what this is all about, remembering the good in people. And there is, in my experience, there is so much goodness in the world. You know, you might not think so when you read the newspapers or watch television, but actually, there is so much kindness out there, so many good people in the world. So see, remember the good sides. And an important part of this, much of this you can't actually do in your meditation practice, right? You have to often build up the perception of goodness over time. You do that in daily life, you meet people in daily life, and you learn gradually to see the other side of these people. And as you build up that perception of the goodness in people, people in your family, people at work, people you meet every day, all of these people are very important to do this thing with. As you build up that perception of kindness, you build up the perception of virtue and goodness and all these good qualities, then as that gets strong, then you can apply it in a meditation practice and shift your perspective and shift your perception. Right? As you sit down and you recognize straight away, why am I worried about this tiny little stupid little thing, right? It's so petty to be worried about this silly little thing. And because you recognize it as a small little petty little thing, it's very easy to shift your attention over to the positive side instead. So this is number one. Just checking the timer. This is number one. Then there are those people in life where it is very hard to see anything good, right? You just can't see the good of certain people. All you see is negative qualities. Again, whether it is just your perception or whether they truly are all bad, sometimes it's very hard to make the distinction. But we have to come from our own perception. So we assume it is all dark, really dark over there, right, for this person. So what do we do then? And then Venerable Sariputta, he says, in this case, when there is nothing positive to focus on, then you take a different tack, and then you focus on compassion instead. Because somebody who has all bad qualities, such a person, is bound to create much more suffering for themselves than for anybody else. And this may not be obvious, but from a Buddhist point of view, this is very... if you understand kind of the way the Buddhist teaching works, is that if you are a person with truly lots of bad qualities, bad actions, bad speech, bad mental qualities, you are essentially creating what in Buddhism is called bad karma. And you are creating a very negative mind for yourself. And that negative mind is a very painful mind, a very difficult mind. And in the future, you can expect to be faced and bring that mind along with you into the future. And when you bring that mind along with you in the future, you're perpetuating a lot of that difficulty and that negativity and experience all the pain as a consequence. So a person who does this, right, they're actually creating suffering for themselves. So how do you, you know, if somebody is creating suffering for themselves, does anybody really want to create suffering for themselves? Nobody wants to do that. They don't understand what they're doing. They are deluded. They are misguided. They are, you know, going down a road where they will experience massive amounts of suffering for themselves in the future. So when you remember that this person, yes, they may be creating a little bit of suffering for me, yes, they may be creating suffering for people around them, but for themselves, it is far, far worse. So instead of being self-centered, look at the other person, and when you do that, compassion starts to rise instead. And what this Venerable Sariputta says, is he says that it's just like a person who is very sick and ill, and they don't have any medicines, they don't have a nurse to look after them, there's nobody, there's no food, there's nothing to drink, nothing to kind of help them out. They're like on a desert road somewhere. And then you see this person walking down this desert road, right? Sick, afflicted, in a terrible state. Then how do you feel when you see that person like that? It's not their fault that they are sick. It's not their fault that they haven't got anybody to help them. You feel a sense of compassion, right? They are moving towards greater sickness. They're moving towards death, possibly. And there's nobody to help them whatsoever. You feel compassion. And you want to go out there and you want to do something for them. In exactly the same way, somebody who is a habitually bad person, you feel exactly the same way as you feel for a sick person in that circumstance. You feel a sense of compassion towards them. So again, this perception too is something that you have to learn to develop, right? When you meet somebody very bad, you have to kind of reflect in that way, and gradually you can turn around the way you regard such people, and actually can give rise to a sense of a positive feeling rather than a negative feeling instead. Yeah. Okay, so that is just a little bit of introduction. Now we will try a bit of meditation and practice and see what happens. So, get ready. I will just give you some nice guidance. So, when you sit down, Okay, good. So, just sit down comfortably. The meditation is going to be about half an hour, so just you're comfortable enough so you can sit for roughly half an hour. Put your feet roughly flat on the floor, and you can have your hands any way you like as long as they're nice and comfortable. And just lean back very slightly against the back of your seat. I'm just going in a bit of details so those of you who are new can get some basic information. Just lean back very slightly. And just feel comfortable in the body. Don't sit in any way that gives rise to pain or anything like that. You're not supposed to torture yourself in any way whatsoever, but just to feel nice in the body. Then, when you feel relatively comfortable, there's no pains in the body, the second thing to look out for is if you have any tensions anywhere. It's important to find that relaxation where you feel completely at ease. It's only then, really, that meditation starts to take off. So scan your body, feel if you have any tensions anywhere. Very often tension accumulates in the stomach region. So feel the stomach region, start there, and feel what it feels like. And if you're not entirely 100% relaxed, then take a few deep breaths. And as you breathe out, just allow everything to relax completely. just keep on feeling the body for now. It's always important to do this quite systematically. And don't go anywhere before you feel really, really nice and relaxed in right there where you're sitting here. Keep on just feeling the body, and wherever you feel you have any tension, that is the place you need to relax. So for example, feel your shoulder region, and if you feel any tension in your shoulders, just imagine yourself breathing in through your shoulders. Allow everything, all the muscles to expand, and as the muscles expand and then you release the breath, everything relaxes nicely. Just keep on feeling your body. Just sitting there, this already increases the sense of awareness, just feeling yourself. And whenever you feel any kind of discomfort or tension anywhere, just place your attention right there. And place your attention there. And just with a little bit of kindness, say to yourself, may you relax, may you be at ease. the idea with this first part of the meditation is to find a state of bodily ease that is deeper than you normally feel in ordinary life. So please notice that as you become more and more relaxed, feeling the body, having a sense of kindness for yourself, just feel how nice it is just to relax 100%. One of the most important aspects of this stage of meditation is the attitude you have towards yourself and towards your body. So remember here to have an attitude of kindness. Say to your body, thank you body for all your services and all your things that you have done for me over all these years. Now it is my return to return that favor to you. May you relax, may you be at ease. May you feel comfortable. Just continue to feel your body, and only when your body is 100% relaxed should you go on to the next stage of the meditation. So if you find that there still are areas where you're not 100% relaxed, just place your attention there and just kind of send some kind thoughts to that area. With kindness, things tend to relax even more. Just try to experience that beautiful sense of peace and tranquility as the body calms down, maybe being more calm than you have ever been before in the body. Just feel how nice that is, how beautiful that is, and what a pleasant experience that is. When the body is completely relaxed, it sort of fades into the background. It's as if the body doesn't matter anymore. And gradually, because the experience is pleasant, you find the mind being in the present moment. So just allow the mind to come into the present moment all by itself. Don't force it, don't do anything particular. Just by allowing the body to calm down, experience the present moment in that way. try to get back to the point where the body sort of disappears into the background because it is so at ease and relaxed. And then just allow the mind to come into the present moment all by itself. The idea at this stage of meditation is just to have the present moment awareness, which means that you are aware of whatever is happening. You don't need to choose anything in particular. All you know it is that things come into existence and things pass away. You may think a little bit, the thought arises, and the thought passes away. You may hear something, the sound arises, and the sound disappears after all. Your job is just to be aware, not to judge good or bad, not to say this is right or wrong, just to have a non-judgmental awareness of whatever is happening right now. again, just try to feel that sense of ease, just being completely passive, not having anything to do. Feel the ease and the sense of sense of beauty here, of just sitting back and not doing anything in the whole world. There's something very powerful about that, and it's so different from our ordinary way of dealing with the world. Okay, so we're now coming to the very end of the meditation. So before we come to the end, I would like you to ask yourself how you feel right now. And if you feel more peaceful, if you feel more at ease than when you started, ask yourself why that is. What have you done? What have you let go of? What kind of perception have you developed over this past half an hour? Experience, a bit unusual, it's very real, right? This is what happens, this is life, it's very real. That's what's very nice about it. Things can always get interrupted, things always aren't this way, so it's quite nice. There's a chance of developing a bit of compassion as well. People collapse like that, so that's good. So, does anyone have any questions about what happened in the meditation, or anything that went wrong, anything that went right, anything that... anything good, anything bad? Anybody feel anything at all? Feel peaceful? Yeah. Anybody have any problems? Anybody have too much thinking? Anybody tired? Yeah. Too much thinking. Okay. Yeah. So what happened when you had too much thinking? Did you just keep going, or did you any peaceful moments? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Good. It's actually one of the most difficult things. I think almost everybody has these kind of problems in the meditation practice, the mind running around, because it's like a habit that you take with you into the meditation. It comes from things in daily life. So the trick with thinking is not to try to suppress it or do anything about it, but just to allow it to be. And when you allow it to be, it tends to diminish all by itself. So your job is just to sit back and kind of observe. And when you're able to observe the thinking, it actually stops very, very, very quickly by itself. because observation means that the thinking is kind of is being undermined in a sense. But what happens is often that you get carried away with the flow, right? And suddenly, oh, what's happening? Where am I now? That's often what happens. That's okay. It's very, very common, and it happens to virtually everybody in meditation practice. So don't worry too much about that. Anybody else have anybody fall asleep? Anybody feeling very tired? No? Everybody doing well? That's another common one, is falling asleep in meditation. Very common. So don't fight it, just relax and just wait till the tiredness goes over. That's usually the best strategy. It's usually very good. Thank you, Rachel, for your kind work. You're doing very well. Excellent. That's very, very good. Compassionate action, right? This is well done. Thank you to you as well. That's very good. Anybody else have anything you want to say about meditation practice?
I found what you were talking about.
Okay, excellent. That's the thing you find, actually. You read the suttas, you read the word of the Buddha, and you put it into practice. It's actually very powerful stuff, you know. And often it's very simple. This is what I like about the teachings of the Buddha. It's actually very simple. It's very straightforward. It's not something very complicated at all. And it's very, very powerful, usually. So, yeah. Good. So you agree with the Buddha. That's good. That's always a positive sign. Okay, great. Anybody else? Everybody else totally happy, absolutely blissed out, no problems whatsoever, just really. Anybody else good? Yeah. No.
Sort
of stressed out. Yeah. Really? Yeah. No, you did very well though by looking after this poor man. I mean, this is difficult. Yeah. So that's great. So thank you for your kind help. That's really, really good.
David's back.
Okay. So I guess we can talk a little bit then. Yeah. Does anybody have any questions you would like to ask about anything here? Well, it has to be within certain limits, of course. Not kind of the spiritual matters. Anybody have any questions you'd like to ask? Everybody has. Nobody has any questions. Okay. What was that?
We can go home.
We can go home. That's right. Okay, that means we can go home. Exactly. Well, thank you. That's a good idea. I haven't thought about that actually. That's an excellent idea. So they say in Buddhism, they say that if you have questions, it's always a good sign. They say questions lead to more wisdom and more intelligence in the future. So it's always good to have questions. But anyway, it's also sometimes nice not to have any questions at all. But I just came back from Indonesia actually on Sunday. I've been there for 10 days, and traveling around from city to city, giving talks everywhere. It's very interesting, the monastic life. You go from this extreme where you go from city to city, always busy, teaching people everywhere, and then you go back to your little hut in the forest and there's nobody around you. It's very kind of extreme. So you have to be very flexible. You have to kind of learn to adapt to these things. But one of the talks I was asked to give there was about building Dhamma family, is what was the title of the talk. And I talked about a few things that make why it is, how it is that Buddhism kind of becomes powerful and important in people's life. What are the relevant factors that make Buddhism so interesting to people and make people actually find it worthwhile to listening to Buddhist teachings? And I think that you can list probably a large number of things, but I think some of the basic things is that, one, Buddhism is about happiness. It's about fun, right? It's about things that people actually want in their life. And you will note, this is one of the, for those of you who know Ajahn Brahm, this is one of the things that he's very good at, right? Making things fun. He's a master of cracking jokes, and he's very light-hearted, and he tells funny stories. And this is one of the, I think, very important aspects of Buddhism. When you find this in people who are kind of spiritually profound or advanced, you find this lightheartedness, this sense of ease. And I think this is a very important reason why this is one of the things that are very attractive, or should be attractive, with the Buddhist teachings. And then there is Another factor is what I would call the factor of relevance. So it should be relevant to people's lives, right? And this is, I think, one of the things, again, that Ajahn Brahm is very good at, one of the things that Buddha is supreme at, right, to make it relevant to people's life. It actually, you use it in your daily interactions with people. You use it at work, you use it at home, and you use it to improve your life, to make your life more meaningful and more happy, less suffering, and all these kinds of things. So it is really supremely relevant. It's something, Buddhism is something that when it's practiced in the right way is used throughout the day in every activity, in everything you do. You take these teachings with you and then they become very powerful and very meaningful. But I think the most important thing that to me anyway makes Buddhism very, you know, so special to me is the profundity of the teaching. It's a very profound and very deep teaching. And that profundity, in a sense, carries both the aspect of happiness, of joy, of fun with it. Because if something is profound from a Buddhist point of view, it is something that leads towards happiness and away from suffering. And it also carries the idea of relevance with it. Something profound from the Buddhist point of view is something which is we actually use to actually take us somewhere in life. But it's also profound in a way that it has like a long way, right? You start to practice these teachings and you can't really see the horizon, but there's a long, long, long way to go with these teachings, going further and further and deeper on the practice. It's very, very beautiful in a sense, this feeling that there is almost no end to the kind of amount of happiness and the amount of reduction of suffering that you can have in your life. So this idea of profundity, I think, is very important, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that and why, how we can get some sense of that profundity of the Buddhist teachings in our own life. Now, one way of doing that is to start reading the Word of the Buddha, right? So you start reading the Word. For those of you who have been Buddhist for a while, have been around for a while, and probably have read some suttas and read some of the Word of the Buddha, after a while you start to get a feeling for these teachings. And then when you read them, you open up the Majjhima Nikaya, right, and you read a story about the Buddha, what he did before his awakening, and how he practiced, and all these kind of things. And you think, wow, isn't this wonderful? You know, here is this man who lived 2,500 years ago, who went through all this hardship and difficulties, trying to purify himself. And then eventually he goes through all these things, attains incredible happiness, and eventually he attains awakening. And when you read these stories and what he did, it's very inspiring, and it's very kind of emotional and very powerful to read these kind of things. Or you read suttas when he talks about how to develop the path for yourself, or he gives little kind of four-line poems when he kind of talks about things very succinctly. It's very, very beautiful and powerful. And for those of you who have been around for a while, who've been practicing for a while, I would recommend you to try to read a little bit of the Word of the Buddha. Because the more you get into that, and the more you kind of start to understand the Buddha's teachings, it has a sense of profundity and depth and power to it that otherwise is very, can be hard to get access to. But for those of you who haven't been around for so long, it can sometimes be a bit daunting perhaps to read the suttas. So there are other ways of getting access to that profundity. Another important way is to see what happens in your own practice, right? Many people, when we practice in the Buddhist path, what you find is over time there is like a slow movement in the right direction. And the right direction in Buddhism means that when you look inside of yourself, you see an improvement in the good qualities of your heart, and you see a decline in the bad qualities. And this is as it should be. So if you look at your practice over the months and over the years, you will see a slow movement in the right direction. That's why I'm still a monk, right? If that hadn't happened to me, I would have been out of here for a long time ago. I wouldn't bother with this path. But because I see this beautiful movement going in the right direction, I'm still practicing this path. And when you start to see that, you gain incredible confidence, right? You put these things into practice and they actually work. They gradually, it's like your outlook, your perception of the world, the way you think about things, everything in your life starts to change. The way you deal with people becomes easier, right? Interpersonal relationships are not as difficult as before. Your enemies become your friends, right? Wow, that's pretty powerful. You have influence on your people like your family. In my experience, this is just from my own personal life, When I first became a monk, my parents said to me, "We have failed in our upbringing. What? Where did we go wrong? This is terrible. You're going into this, you know, this cult and disappearing for us. Ah, we, you know, this is absolutely." So my parents, especially my father, was really kind of, "Oh no, what's going on here?" And then over time, things have changed, right? And they change and change and change. Not because I try to convert them or tell them what is right, but basically that's because I try to do the right thing here. And then one day, my parents said to me, "Oh, teach us something meditation. Teach us some about Buddhism, right?" So now whenever I go back and visit my parents back in Norway, they come and have me sit down with them and they say, "Teach us meditation practice." This is the power of this teaching. If you do it right, it changes everything. It changes your interpersonal relationships. And one day my father said to me, this is astonishing, I don't know how this happened, but this is what happened. He said to me, "You know, Stan is my name. You know, Stan, I used to be your teacher, now you're my teacher." Isn't that amazing? This is your father, right? Your father is supposed to be always your teacher. Things just turn around so astonishingly here. So this is the power of this Dhamma. It kind of carries you forward. And then when you start to see that your life changes, your thinking changes, your perception changes, your views start to change about the world, you start to realize that this is not just a change that you have gone so far, but you start to understand that this is going to continue, right? If you continue with this practice in the same way, then you can sort of start to see that this is heading in a direction that is a very positive and very beautiful direction where this is all going here. So this is the second way of understanding the profundity of the teachings. A third way, and this is perhaps the main topic of tonight's, well, only got 10 minutes, that's okay. So, and this is sometimes to meet people or to hear stories about people who have some of those qualities that the Buddha is talking about. And this is very interesting, especially when you're a monk, because you get to meet lots of other monks. And some of these monks are very inspiring. Sometimes the lay people too are very, very inspiring, and the nuns are inspiring. But obviously, my experience is mostly with monks. And because monks are dedicated 100% to the spiritual path, you can expect sometimes to see very powerful results with some of these monastics, right? And one of the things, of course, in our tradition, we are a forest tradition, so we tend to live quite secluded in the forest. And some of these monks, they live in in seclusion that is absolutely astonishing. You wouldn't kind of believe what kind of seclusion they live in. You know, you think Bodhinyana Monastery is seclusion. That is like nothing compared to what some of these people live. And there was one monk in Sri Lanka. He was he's the kind of monk who just loves seclusion. And he disappears into the forest, right? And I think the first 5 years of his life, as his monastic life, he would sort of be around other monks and he would learn about the Buddhist teaching and learn the basics of meditation, right? And after that, he would disappear into the forest. And he would just disappear into the forest and he would build these huts for himself in the forest. Sometimes he get a bit of help from the local villagers. And these huts that he would build would be three-sided huts, right? This is in the jungle in Sri Lanka. They were on stilts, true enough, but they were three-sided huts. So one side is completely open. This is in Sri Lanka, in the jungle. There are snakes, there are panthers, there are, you know, there are elephants, all kind of stuff, right? So, but he said it's a bit like a cave, right? Because you have an opening in front and you have three sides around you. So sometimes he said he would kind of wake up in the morning and there would be like a snake next to him, right? Like, "Good morning, snake. how are you?" So this is how they live. And then after living in the jungle for like 51 weeks of the year, he would come out of the jungle for 1 week, and then he would discuss with his fellow monks and talk about his experience, talk about his meditation. And after 1 week of kind of discussing things, he would disappear back into the jungle again and disappear in the jungle. And one of the stories that he also told is that he said one day he was sitting in meditation under a tree. And after he came out of his meditation, he had this snake around him, right, curled around him. And this was one of those very, very venomous snakes. And the snake was kind of, his head was very, very close to his head. So he had to be very, very careful. So what he did is sort of, you know, trying to think very fast, what do I do in this kind of situation? So he looked above him, and there was a branch not far above him. So very, very, very slowly, carefully, he puts his hand up, right? and then eventually lifts it up to grab the branch. And then he says to the snake, okay, snake, this is, go up to this branch. And then the snake slowly kind of curls up and goes up to the branch above him. So these are the kind of stories. And the point here is that the purpose of these kind of stories is not just to, and it's nice to tell fun stories and stories that are kind of, you know, different from what you normally hear, but the main point of these stories is that somebody who lives like that, who lives completely apart from the world, who lives in very difficult circumstances, you know, basically lives, sleeps on the wooden floor every day, he walks for arms round into the local village once a day to get his food, and otherwise he just stays in the jungle all the time. The point of this, and what is so powerful about this, is that the only way you can sustain that over a long period of time is if you find happiness, and you find contentment, and you find peace somewhere else. So what you're seeing here, in a sense, is somebody who has a very, very powerful source of happiness and contentment from away, apart from the ordinary worldly happiness that people have. So this is what you see when you see people who live like that. The only way that is sustainable is if you have that particular thing. And that is what is so powerful about it. And another example is another monk from Sri Lanka. He was also very famous for being very spiritually attained. And he spent most of his life in Sri Lanka just walking around, never staying in one particular place. Just walking around all the time. For 35 years, he walked around non-stop. Basically non-stop all the time. And then he would find a nice place and he would kind of spend some time in that place while the meditation was going well. And if the meditation didn't go well anymore, he would then get up and he would walk on to the next place. And then one day when he was doing this, one of his supporters, they would see him and he was walking down the street, right? And they were kind of walking towards a crossroad. There was a crossroad just down the street. And the supporter wanted to help him. So he wanted to find out where he was going. So I said, Bhante is like venerable, right, saying to the monk, Bhante, when you come down to that crossroad, which was only a few meters down there, which way are you going to go? Are you going to go left or going to go right? And he said, I will find out when I get there. Right? So this idea that you don't have any desires, you don't really know what you're going to do. You make your choices at the very last moment when you have to. No kind of plans or anything, just moving, going with the flow all the time. This is another one of those things, right? When you go down the road, how often is that you go and you don't know until you get there? Oh, left or right? Okay, left. And you keep on going like that. It's very profound and very beautiful again. And one of the supreme examples of the power of meditation is also Ajahn Brahm, right? Most of you probably know about Ajahn Brahm. He's the abbot of down the monastery down in Serpentine. About 10 years ago, he went on a six-month meditation retreat. And during those 6 months, he was on his meditation retreat. All he did was live in a tiny little hut in the forest at Bodhinana Monastery. The huts there are about 7 square meters, right? That's where he lived for 6 months. In that hut, he had one thing, a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya. This is one of the books of the Buddhist texts that we have in the Pali Canon. And that was one thing he had there. And then outside he had a walking path, right? So you walk up and down on that walking path. And that's all he had for 6 months, right? Most people will go absolutely nuts. Tiny little place where he stayed for 6 months. And he didn't speak to anyone. He didn't see anybody for those 6 months. He would collect his food from a box where he put his food. One day he said he had seen one of the monks in the distance, but he had been on retreat for so long, he couldn't even remember his name, right? His name had kind of disappeared. This was one of his ordained monks. And then, of course, whereas most people, you know, basically can't take that kind of thing, it's incredible, it's very, very difficult to be that long completely by yourself. Then, of course, Ajahn Brahm comes off his retreat, and then he says, oh, 6 months of bliss, right? This was the first talk he gave. He gave a talk to the monastery in the monastery. And the name of the talk was 6 months of bliss after he came out. And again, this shows you that if you practice this path in a different way, if you start to understand where this path is heading, it is a completely different way of looking at the world, understanding the mind, understanding everything, from how we ordinarily understand things in ordinary life. The highest bliss is not found in ordinary daily activities. The highest bliss is found in giving all that up, right? And the only way you can do that is to find the inner happiness, the happiness of the mind. And that happiness is far, 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 far more powerful than anything you can experience in ordinary life. So isn't that a beautiful thing to know that these things exist? It kind of lifts you up. You feel that there is something in life which is very powerful and very beautiful. Something that kind of carries you forward and gives you a sense that there is something in this world really worth striving for and really worth heading to. So even though most of you will probably never be monastics, at least, which is fine, it's okay. I mean, sometimes it's very hard to do these things. They're very difficult because of all kind of reasons. But at least there is something there which you can kind of aspire to in your heart, something which you can move towards, something very profound and very beautiful. And the Buddha actually says in the sutta, he says that just being able to see somebody who was awakened in this world, right? These monks I've been talking about now, these are all very, if they're not fully awakened, at least they're getting very close, right? It's the only way you can do this kind of thing. So just seeing a person like that, seeing somebody who is different, right? You see somebody who is virtually almost always at peace, who is virtually always has a kind thing to say, has a sense of humor in any kind of difficult situation, right? If the whole world turns against them, they just shrug their shoulders and kind of move on. It's no big deal, right? This is a power, very powerful sense of inner freedom and independence. When you see that, just seeing that thing is in itself very powerful, because you understand, again, that there's something there that you also would like to have, right? I can do with some of those qualities myself, that's what you tend to think. So this is the third way of understanding the profundity of the Buddha's teachings, in actually seeing those examples, hearing some of those stories. And please also, you can also talk about these things among yourselves, because I've always found that if I hear stories of other people getting nice meditation, it's uplifting, right? You feel happy. If other people can do it, it means you can do it, right? We're all basically the same. It's very uplifting and very beautiful and very, very profound.